Hey, are we live yet? Are we live yet? Testing. 1, 2, 3. Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's online podcast with your host, Jan Irvin. Here we investigate the religious, the mysterious, the entheogenic, the shamanic, and the Gnostic with the small g. Haven't heard it someplace else, you'll likely hear it here. So sit back and relax. Take a trip through time and a journey through your mind as we investigate the ancient mysteries.
Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 25. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. Today's guest is Professor Carl Ruck. What do Snow White, Red Riding Hood, werewolves, ogres, fairies, Apollo, willy bears, dwarfs, St. Anthony's Fire, Bacchus, and drugs have to do with each other? What are the origins of the ancient European myths, legends, and fairy tales? Did Europe have an ancient history embedded in drug shamanism from where these stories originate? And what were the Eleusinian mysteries? Has this area of study been suppressed in the U.S. by other scholars? Professor Carl Ruck has been on this show before. He was in podcast number 1. He's just come back from Greece and from Ulysses, and he's here to talk about the ancient mysteries of Europe. So stay tuned for that. Professor Carl Ruck is one of the original founders of the fields of ethnomycology and ethnobotany. He was the primary contributor for the famed book, The Road to Ulysses, that's just now come out in its 30th anniversary edition. He also contributed to Persephone's Quest with Gordon Wasson and Jonathan Ott. He also contributed to such books as The World of Classical Myth, Gods and Goddesses, Heroines and Heroes, and also Apples of Apollo, Pagan and Christian Mysteries of the Eucharist, and Sacred Mushrooms of the Goddess, as well as The Hidden World, which is one of the books that we'll be talking about today, which is the subtitle is Survival of Pagan Shamanic Themes in European Fairy Tales. And he's also got an upcoming book that is called Mushrooms, Myth, and Mithras, The Drug Cult That Civilized Europe. He's the inventor of the word entheogen, and he's also the professor of the classics department at Boston University. Upcoming shows. We've got Dr. Dennis McKenna on next week, and that's already recorded and ready to go. Also coming up will be Professor Emeritus Marlene Dobkin de Rios discussing her book, A Hallucinogenic Tea Laced in Controversy, Ayahuasca in the Amazon and the United States. And also coming up will be Dr. Marguerite Rigoglioso, and she'll be discussing her new book that will be out on the day of this interview with her, which will be April 27th, and her new book is The Cult of Divine Birth in Ancient Greece, and this is going to be a good one. We'll be discussing ancient fertility rites. And if anybody out there in the audience can help do transcriptions, I've been asking for people that can help with that over the last couple of weeks. I've got several volunteers, but we still have a few other shows that we could use help on. So if you can help with that, please do contact me. I really appreciate it. And there's a couple of different ways to go about it, but contact me. There's a few shows left, maybe one that's one of your favorite shows that you can help us with. Also donations. I really appreciate everyone who has donated recently. It's been very helpful. Unfortunately, times are very tough right now. And so if any of you out there can donate or hopefully purchase a copy of one of the books or DVDs off the website, we can really use your support right now. Things have really slowed down with the economy. So if you're out there and you've been thinking about buying a copy of one of the books or the DVD, The Pharmacratic Inquisition, please do so. That would be greatly appreciated. And the color edition of Astrotheology and Shamanism is now out, and that is going out with a free copy of the Pharmacratic Inquisition DVD. Or you can get the black and white edition for about $23 with shipping included in that. Or my newest book, The Holy Mushroom. And you can do all of that from the website at GnosticMedia.com. That's GnosticMedia.com. And for those of you who would rather purchase the books or the DVD from Amazon, they are also available on Amazon. If you want to find the color edition of Astrotheology and Shamanism on Amazon, you have to go to the black and white edition first, and then you can see other editions listed there. Anyway, I guess that's it. If anyone would like to contact me directly, please feel free to contact me at contact@gnosticmedia.com. And, by the way, I did have to get a new audio card, so, hopefully everything is fixed on this show, but, or for this introduction, but I think on the actual interview here was when my audio card was actually in the process of failing, so... hopefully it was all sorted out, but here we go. Enjoy the show. Hello, Carl.
Yeah? Am I coming through okay?
Yeah, I hear you fine. Am I coming through okay?
Yep, fine.
How are you today?
Okay, it's rainy here. I've been doing the images for the Mithras book, and so I'm playing around with the paintbrush. I just washed it, so it won't get hard. So, what do you want to talk about?
Oh, well, I'd love to get into your book, The Hidden World, as well as Ulysses. And if you want to talk a little bit about your Mithras book, that would be okay. I'm really excited to get my hands on that when that goes to print. So, you know, there's a few directions we could take it, but definitely your Hidden World book, I think, your work in there definitely needs more.
Well, you've read The Hidden World.
Oh yeah.
You wrote something for us about
yeah.
it.
Yeah, and I think that
you know anything that has to deal with mushrooms tends to bring out a certain rabid people, and so the first reviewer who gave it such a low rating on Amazon. It's the mere fact that anyone thought that there were mushrooms anywhere. It just makes people see red.
I agree with you, and that's part of the reason why I wanted to have you on the show is that I think The Hidden World gets far too little notice. It's been in print since, what, 2006?
I don't remember.
Or 2006 or 2007. Anyway, it's been about two years.
Yeah.
And it deserves a lot more recognition, in my opinion, that it's getting. So that was...
We made an effort not to focus only on mushrooms, and that first reviewer only saw the mushrooms. And it's really, you know, disappointing. I mean, there's a whole chapter about Aristophanes' parody of Socrates in the clouds, which has to do with cannabis smoke, and the reviewer didn't notice anything about that, nor has anybody else. I mean, no one ever talks to me about my works.
Well, and not only that, but you go deep into discussions on Datura, Mead, henbane, and a number of other substances. So,
yeah, I know.
So that you know, the attacks are completely invalid that you see mushrooms everywhere. But you know, regardless of the fact, you know, these drugs, as you know, I just interviewed. David Hillman, the author of The Chemical Muse, and had him on my show recently. And, you know, it's just like his work proves, when you go in and you actually look at these ancient texts, it's right there, but nobody's talking about it.
Well, you know, he was told, apparently, I had an email from him, that he would never get a job in classics because of what he wrote. You know, and this is absolutely outrageous because the procedure in scholarship is that you read something and you refute it. You look at the evidence. If you don't like it, you look at the evidence and show that it was misused or that there is no evidence, rather than to just decide that the person can't teach. In fact, the work wouldn't even get reviewed.
Yeah, that's
just a matter of ignoring it. And it's strange because I'm reading a book, a very good book by an art historian on distorted images of the human form in Greek vase painting. And it's a very scholarly book, and it doesn't have anything to do with drugs. But one of the vases discussed is a parody of Circe offering the potion to Odysseus. And the writer mentions that she's offering him a strong drink of wine or perhaps some kind of drug. And it just creeps in. I mean, this person obviously knows that drugs were used and has probably read my work. And... But it's better not even to mention it. But it obviously affects the way he sees things. But if you come out too openly talking about drugs and antiquity, you're going to get into trouble. And it's complicated why that should be the case. Part of it has to do with the fact that our nation's caught in this disastrous war against drugs, which has something to do with it. But more than that, it has to do with the tendency of classical scholars, because people in anthropology, history, and sociology, and so forth, they don't have this problem. But the classical philologists are trained in a tradition of idealizing classical antiquity. It's some kind of model of perfection. And people within the classical profession who aren't, strictly classical philologists, the ones studying literature, like historians, I mean, they're pointing out really horrible things about the basic nature of Athenian democracy, the suppression of women, things of that kind. But there still is this feeling that the literature itself is portraying some kind of perfection.
Right. You know, and I think you're familiar with Marguerite Rigoglioso. Are you familiar with her work?
No, I'm not.
Okay, she goes, I'm going to have her on the show soon talking about the role of women in ancient cultures and, fertility cults and things like that. David Hillman had mentioned to me that he thought that you had cited her in your last book. I'll have to double check that, but, she just goes into a lot more of this underlying theme that, you know, that things aren't exactly how the general field of classics wants us to believe, this whole idealistic form of history that's been sort of fed to us, you know. And then here you are, and here David Hillman are sitting here as sort of a couple, and maybe with Mark and Jose as well. You're sitting there as sort of the only people in the entire field arguing something contrary.
Yeah. And there's also a strong Christian bias in classical scholarship. And so obviously ancient religion was wrong, but they like to see that it was in some way anticipating the coming of Christ. And there's definitely a prejudice against considering any Eastern influences on classical religion or classical culture. And so, they're already fighting the battle against the Muslims before the Muslims existed.
Would you? Yeah, interesting. I had to stop and think about that one for a minute. What I want to do, I don't want to focus too much on, you know, and, you know, I did
put it. Yeah, we should talk about successes because I'm just back from Greece.
Yeah.
And the trend in American classical scholarship is not worldwide, and it looks as though my work on Eleusis is being embraced by the Greeks. I mean, the two Greek translations, great enthusiasm for the presentation at the Benaki, and the co-presenters for that were two Greek scholars. One is actually the archaeologist who's now in charge of the excavation at Eleusis, and she gave us a private tour after hours of the sanctuary and the museum. And so obviously in her presentation she says that something happened in the mystery which was not ordinary reality, and she's written her work very, very carefully. And the other presenter was a person who for over a decade has been involved in drug therapy for addiction, and he feels that a knowledge of the role of drugs in religion and antiquity is, and in culture in general, is part of the way of combating addiction. And so, although he's open to the use of drugs like Ibogaine for therapy, his main manner of therapy is exercise and drama, as a matter of fact.
So, could you talk a little? Well, you know, I wanted to also mention that the 30th anniversary edition of the Road to Ulysses has just come out, and I had Peter Webster on the show recently to discuss his work that was in the new 30th anniversary edition that sort of corrected and corroborated some of Albert Hoffman's work. That was really, in my opinion, that was really, I mean, Wasson proposed the theory and Hoffman did the chemistry, but that was really your work in that book, and which I think you as...
That's what the people in Greece said, that the really important part about the work on Eleusis is the fact that I discussed the nature of Greek wine as an intoxicating mixture of various herbs added to the wine. And because the attitude of classical scholarship has been that for some reason the Greeks had very little tolerance for wine, even though their whole society is centered upon the drinking of it ritually and socially, but somehow they couldn't take it.
Right, and most people think that, the ancients just couldn't handle 12% alcohol. It's some of the most ridiculous arguments out there, but it's, you know, it's clear, and Stephen Booner, who is the author of Sacred and Herbal Healing Beers, has done a lot of work on the ancient mead and wines and things like that, and in his book, and I also had him on the show recently, he argues very thoroughly that that the wine had other substances in it, and he also brings up some very fascinating stuff on the Catholic beer called Gruet that was psychoactive, that was prohibited by the Protestants in the 16th century in the Rheinz-Hotzgebot, or however you pronounce that, the Beer Purity Act. And there is a whole tradition of these ancient beverages being filled with exotic herbs and drugs and things like that, unfortunately, very few people are willing to go into that area of research and talk about what it really was about.
But do you know about the work of Michael Ranella?
I am not familiar with his work.
He's been an editor at the University of New York at SUNY. And about 10 years ago, he wrote an essay, which I read, and I think I met him about that time, too. And so in the interim, he's been working on, he's a philosopher and sociologist, and he's been working on an extension of the paper that I saw some years ago. He's one of the people who's taken my work seriously and then, you know, gone ahead with it. And what he's done is to show that Plato's attitude to intoxication, in order to understand what he's saying, you have to take seriously what I said about the nature of Greek wine and the strong intoxicating effects of it. And then he goes on to show that the outcome of the symposium by these aristocratic young men was often that they were so high that they'd go out in the street and raise a ruckus and get into brawls and things of that kind. And that Plato's reaction to this is that that kind of intoxication is wrong. And so the whole prohibition against drugs. People have said that all of history is just a footnote to Greece, and once again, it's the truth. The puritanic prohibition of drugs goes back to Plato, and it's also the same tradition that has surfaced over and over again in the course of Western history. And what Plato says is essentially that we have to lie to the people. We know what the truth is, and because we have superior mentality, and we can do things of that kind. But the common people have to be told some propagandistic version, so that they'll be kept in control. And so lie, because much of the war against drugs today involves lying too. Many of the people involved in the war against drugs are also involved in taking drugs, and it's even suspected that many of them are in the pay of the drug lords, some of them at least. It's to the advantage of everyone involved to keep the drugs illegal, because that drives the price up. Once they're legal, they're worth nothing.
That's very true.
I don't know how much I believe of all these conspiracy theories, but something's going on.
Well, something definitely is, and you know, just the fact that they refused to allow industrial hemp into the whole equation is something that brings a lot of attention. I wanted to have you discuss some of the rites and the mysteries regarding Ulysses, and then from there, maybe we could move forward, historically speaking, into your work in the hidden world regarding the myths, the European myths and fairy tales, and I'd love to have you discuss lycanthropy and the story of the bears and things like that.
Another, and I was talking about hypocrisy, and I think one of the very important essays in the Hidden World is the second chapter about heretical visionary sacraments amongst the ecclesiastical elite. And it, we show, by examining two masterpieces of Renaissance art, that people who were very high up in the church were, in fact, doing things which officially were prohibited by the church. And so it's the Platonic solution. It's okay for me, but not for you.
You also did a video on that. For those who have not read your book, they can go on Peter Webster's, what is it, psychedelic-library.org, that they can get that from?
Yeah, it's included in the book, but it is available on the web.
Right.
The Psychedelic Library.
Sorry about that. What can you, you know, and I know that's in the video in the book, but would you be willing to sort of give a summary of your research on that and some of the other myths, or lead us from Ulysses and from your work there, and possibly the, you know, these groups that were healing the ergot poisoning. I forget the name of the you know, yes, exactly, St. Anthony. You know, I'd love to have you discuss that and, you know, at least summarize
it. Rather let people hear the whole argument because they can access it easily on the web or through the book. But you start out thinking that you're going to find images of mushrooms everywhere, and some people are deluded into thinking that anything is fungal in shape. It is, in fact, a mushroom. And you and I have talked about this often, and we have some disagreements on identifications. But sometimes there are things that are unmistakably mushrooms. They have to be placed in the context so you know that you're not just making it up. But beyond that, it's a very sophisticated vocabulary, artistic vocabulary. And so once you realize that there's a phenomenon of anthropomorphization of plants, turning plants into animals, and so often what appears to be, some kind of interesting fantasy creature is actually an anthropomorphized spirit of a magical plant. And this is certainly the case with the fairies.
And what about werewolves and things like that? What can you tell us about werewolves? And what about, if you wouldn't mind...
That is fascinating because there were four of us writing the book, and I ended up trying to reconcile the material that the other three were presenting me. And I got to the point where I had to say, do you believe that werewolves exist? I mean, we can't just go on and talk about this. Is this just a fantasy, or are there werewolves? And we came upon that interesting case in one of the Baltic countries around 1500 or so, an old guy who was accused. You've read the book, so you know that. He's accused of, actually I got it from another classical scholar who, even earlier than Hillman and Ranella, apparently was influenced by my work. He sent me a copy of his work. It's on Apollo, the Wolf God. It's a very, very interesting book.
Can you speak up just a little bit for the audio level?
Okay. And it's a very, very interesting book. But he cites a law case in Latvia, I think, of an old guy who's brought to trial for being a werewolf. And it's not one of those Inquisition trials. The prosecutor doesn't want to cause any trouble for this old guy. And so he's trying to prove to them that he's not a wolf. And so apparently they met in some kind of coven, and they did things and thought that they turned into wolves, and they thought that they were benefiting the crops by doing that. And so they turn into wolves, and then they eat things. And do you eat it raw? No, well, we cook it. And well, how can you cook it? If you have hands, and so you can manage to do that. And then the prosecutor says something like, well, don't the dogs protect you when you attack the flocks? And he says, oh, yeah. And so what do you do? And he says, there you have it. We outrun them because we're wolves. But anyway, the guy was let off. But do people actually turn into wolves?
And it seems this whole...
Well, it has to do with whether we have more than one reality. And if you shift into another reality, of course, other things are possible.
The cases of lycanthropy seem to be global. It doesn't seem to be limited to Europeans. Certainly the Native Americans had similar stories of lycanthropy, and as of other cultures. Can you talk about...
I think it has to do with accessing different potentials through rituals of shamanism. But that doesn't mean to say that when you access that potential, it's only an imagining that you do it. I've talked to many people who have had unusual experiences, and people who are quite reputable, and they're not making it up, but they, I mean, you can imagine that you've gone someplace out of your body, and of course it's only a fantasy or a dream, that sort of thing, but it seems to be that when you do that, you actually can come back with information that you would not have been privy to unless you'd actually taken the journey, which would mean that the shamanic journey is not a fantasy trip. It's an actual stepping through the membrane between this reality and another. And we know from basic physics now that our whole concept of the physical world is flawed, that it's not the way we imagine it. I mean, we live in a world that we imagine, and if we can imagine it differently, then there's another world that we could live in.
Talk about...
If you're following that.
Oh, I'm totally following that. Can you talk about the story of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs?
Well, that's where the fairy tale book began. Jose Alfredo, our Spanish colleague, wrote a paper in Spanish, and I read it. I was still studying my Spanish. It was good for me. And then we translated it originally for an essay in the journal Entheos, and that sort of expanded and became the beginning of the whole fairy tale book. But as we got into it, the dimensions of the subject became immense, and so it went in many different directions, especially since Jose Alfredo is trained as a mythologist, and so he kept leading us into other cultures' myths.
And you go through quite a history of many different Grimm fairy tales and other fairy tales.
Yeah.
You talk about the... You go into the story of Little Red Riding Hood and how...
Oh, yeah, well, that's the most obvious one of an anthropomorphized mushroom and probably the Amanita muscaria. Doesn't mean that that's the one that they're eating, but it means it's the one that seems to incite the most fantasy life. But the fact that her hood is called a riding hood... In German, she's not called that. She's just called Little Red Cap, which is interesting because the Red Cap, probably in addition to referring to the top of the red mushroom, it probably is a perpetuation of Mithraic rites because Mithras and the followers of Mithras are characterized by having that special Phrygian cap, red cap. And a pointed one, in fact. And so she probably is a continuation of that as well. But in German, she's just a little red cap. But the fact that she's called Riding Hood means that you put that cap on when you take a trip. And that's because there's an earlier version of the fairy tale in English where she's called Little Red Riding Hood. And so that's why it's translated that way. It's not... actually translating the Grimm title.
So it should be more titled more accurately, Little Red Tripping Cap or something like that.
Well, that's what it is, yes.
So basically she's being eaten by the wolf, and then the story is that...
Yeah, when you're eaten by the wolf, of course you become a wolf. I mean, there's no easier way to become a wolf than to be eaten
by it. So it leads back to the whole werewolf thing and lycanthropy that
yes.
we were just discussing.
Yes.
And then she is cut out of the hunter's belly. Could you talk about what is the...
But there again, I mean, I trace that back to classical precedents, and so this fantasy of lycanthropy is well documented in the two plays of Euripides.
So what is the story of Wily Bear?
That too. I mean, we trace it back to classical antiquity, and Odysseus it's complicated, you know, and people won't understand it if I go through the argument quickly on the phone. But the disappearance of Odysseus has as its pattern the hibernation of the bear. And this, too, is not something we made up. It's something that was well documented by another classical scholar. We just carry it a bit further. And in fact, it came upon an Etruscan version of the disappearance of Odysseus. And that tradition is, you know, because he went away for 20 years. 10 years at the war and 10 years trying to get back home. And the way he gets back home is he falls asleep on a magical ship, and when he wakes up, he's back home. And the whole trip of coming home in Greek tradition is called the Naustos. And so there were many, many myths about the homecoming. But by its etymological basis, the homecoming doesn't mean the homecoming, it means the return to this reality. It's the return to this perception of reality. It's the return to the perceiving mind, which is the nous. So it's the awakening back to this consciousness. But the Etruscan version of the myth is that Odysseus became so sleepy that he was getting hard to find. And it goes back to prehistory, the Paleolithic, where people would live in caves and would be probably living along with a bear who was sleeping through the winter in the cave. And so that the magic of the bear being able to disappear and come back again was a clue as to what the basic nature of reality might be.
So you don't think they actually killed the bear? You think they would just live right alongside the bear?
Yeah, they would live while the bear was sleeping. Bears are dangerous, and so they couldn't befriend the bear. But there is the tradition that a bear, since the bear is bigger than a human, but walks upright, often like a human. And in addition to that, the bear is an animal that responds to the pheromone of the human. And so bears are attracted by menstruating women, humans. And so it's very much like us. And there's the tradition that inside a bear is actually a human who's been caught in its bear form. And that when you kill a bear, you're actually liberating the person to return to its human form. And so there are cultures that befriend a bear cub and treat it like a child in the family. And then when the bear gets large enough so it's causing trouble, and then they have the special sacrifice to liberate the person from its bare form. But people, these traditions are so fundamental, they occur without people being aware of it. Why are the organizations of children called bear cubs and brownies and things like that? And I don't know how true it is, but I was part of a documentary that some people were filming, and so I didn't know the person who testified to this, but it was on people's fascination with mushrooms, and they were obviously influenced by the work that I'd done, but they took it in a different direction. And there's a woman on it who says that when she was a brownie, they used to dance around a giant manita. Now, I'm sure that all the Cub Scouts aren't doing that sort of thing, but someone was doing something strange with her initiates.
How do all of these stories tie into sun worship and stories like Orion and things like that? Or star worship, I should say, not sun worship.
Star worship. Well, star worship and sun worship, they're really related, aren't they?
Aren't they, yes, as well as moon worship. But can you talk about, like, the story of Orion?
Well, I don't know if he's so much involved with sun worship.
Well, with the star worship and the mushroom and the Orion and urine and that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, he definitely has a strange myth. That his father was a beekeeper, and he was actually inseminated by the urine from three gods who visited his father and peed on a bullhide. And so we think that's very suggestive of the traditions about Amanita muscaria. But I think in one of your emails you were triumphant in saying that it's not only Amanita muscaria that passes into the urine, other drugs do too. Am I right that you wrote me that?
Yes, and in fact, I need to follow up with Tom Roberts on that because he wanted to send that out or publish it or something.
Yeah, I don't know whether, obviously it's true, otherwise drug testing with urine wouldn't be a procedure. But I don't know whether it passes into the urine in sufficient quantities to serve as a second source of the intoxication. That's something that one would have to check. Didn't you say something about it working with psilocybin?
Yes, it works. It worked extremely well.
Yeah, so it does apparently with some substances recycle.
Yet,
do you know about Alan Piper? He hasn't written very much because he's involved in working for the social welfare in England, but he has a great interest in drugs and their involvement in European traditions. So I don't know if you know about him or not.
Well,
but
I've heard.
I mentioned it because he would be a person that you might want to interview.
Okay. Actually, I have come across his work a few times. I think mainly through you and through correspondences.
He knows a tremendous amount about the involvement of the artistic avant-garde at the end of the 19th, early 20th century. In drug experiences and how it becomes involved in the production of their writing and their art. We went to Barcelona together. We're fascinated by the works of Gaudí and the church that he's building as a kind of temple to nature and the housing estate that he designed for his wealthy patron, where the gatehouse has Amanita muscarias on the top of the building. And they're well recognized as mushrooms and as Amanita muscaria. And his patron, in fact, there was a cartoon of his patron in the newspaper, and it showed these gate buildings in the background with the mushroom tops and Count Guel, his name is Guel, was picking mushrooms. but the interesting thing about that is that he was a very high placed in society and was a devout Catholic, and no one seemed to have any trouble with the fact that in addition to that, he was a Freemason and had an interest in mushrooms and obviously psychoactive mushrooms. So we were very interested in perhaps pursuing that, and we may still do that. But it turns out there's actually a very scholarly essay on the work of Gaudí in Spanish, and it is about the fact that Gaudí's work is the realization of visions he had during a psychoactive intoxication.
As far as Alan, you had referred his work to me probably a couple of times over the last year or so. So that's I suppose I'm probably only familiar with him through your work, but I do have his contact information, so I will definitely follow up with him, and I'd love to find out more of what type of research he's done.
You apparently have interviewed Brian Ackers, right?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I just interviewed Brian yesterday. Brian and I have been in communication quite a lot over the last few months. And go ahead.
Did he mention the Neolithic rock fresco that we're working on?
Yes, he said he didn't want to go into too much detail on it, but he said that there was a pretty major discovery that was made that totally proves everything in European culture, and it was that. So, is he working on that with you, or is that Alan Piper, or who's doing that?
Well, there are six of us, and Brian is one of them, and Alan's another.
Oh, okay, great. Yeah, I don't recall. I'll have to, I have to edit Brian's interview, and it will be actually going out tonight at around midnight for Monday. But I don't recall if he brought that up or not. He may have mentioned it briefly, but I'll definitely look into that some more as well. But yeah, Brian is a very interesting character. He and I have spent many hours on the phone conversing over these topics. You mentioned bees a few minutes ago. Could you go into the significance of bees and mead and sort of the role that that whole aspect connects back in possibly with the Grecian themes that we were discussing earlier?
Well, it is such a complex combination of metaphors. It's absolutely fascinating, and I can't, I can't go through it all here, although I've done it in the writing. But it begins, first of all, with the fact that bees, like all insects, but it's quite noticeable in bees, are matriarchal society. And so they would have a special significance for cultures that had a goddess rather than a god. It is so fundamental. Anyone looking inside a hide can see that the bee is that the ovating bee is the center of the colony. I just came upon. I can't quite remember the details now, but I did write about it just recently. The eggs, which are fertilized, produce the drones, I think, and the ones that aren't fertilized produce the females. It's weird.
Well, and isn't it the bees that the female that eats the royal jelly is the one that becomes the queen and lives for years and all of these interesting little facets?
Yeah. Many people have written whole books on the bee, as a matter of fact. But to give you some idea of the complexity of it, the name of the bee is probably onomatopoetic. It's the buzzer, and commonly people refer to the experience of getting intoxicating as getting a buzz without having any idea of what they're saying. But so the bee is involved with that. But in addition to that, the bee produces honey, which is sweet and very nourishing. And it obviously also produces poisons, otherwise it couldn't sting you. And the observable source of both the honey And the sting is the fact that they go to flowers and gather it. And so they become implicated intrinsically with the whole metaphor of herb gatherers and toxic and medicinal substances. Then they become also involved with the fact that the honey is not only honey, but it makes your voice sweet and beautiful, and so it becomes the source of inspiration and poetry and that sort of thing. They're actually, as you know, Minoan gold rings show women who are depicted not with the faces of humans, but with insect faces as they go gathering their flowers.
Yeah, you know, I have seen a lot of those depictions now that I think about it. I still remember, I hear that clock in the background. I remember that.
Yeah, I have a lot of clocks.
Yeah, I remember from last time that clock was chiming into the interview quite often as well then.
That's the one that tells the wrong time. Sometimes some of the clocks tell the right time and some tell the wrong time. I think, I might as well sound a bit crazy. I think it's the confusion of time that allows you to access different realities. Because obviously time is totally relative.
Yeah, exactly. It is. Yeah, that's interesting. Maybe
it's good to keep a few clocks to give you the wrong time all the time.
I never thought of it that way. I'll have to incorporate that into my philosophy. Thanks for I don't know if that was something that just contributed to or poisoned my mind, but I'll figure that out in times to come. Would you discuss the Melusina of Plaine-Carolt? Another fascinating bit of work that you've done there, but and I know you've done a video on that as well, but maybe we could provide enough to listeners so that they're enticed to either go read the book and or see the video as well.
Yeah, well, everybody knows the famous fresco, Plaine-Carolt, and what we have done is, I think, provide the myth that surrounds the culture that produced it, and it has to do with the very common myth in Europe of Melusina, who is a fairy creature, and when she enters into a union with her chosen mate, she offers him great felicity and wealth as long as he abides by one prohibition. He must never see her on Saturday when she takes a bath, because obviously when he sleeps with her, he would have noticed this too, so it's a myth. But when she takes a bath, it becomes obvious that her bottom half is a fish or a serpent, and so her knight, of course, becomes curious and does see her, and then she has to leave him, and it becomes involved with the whole tradition of what you do with the old goddess of pagan times when she moves on into Christian times, and she has to be let go, and she also becomes Christianized. So Melusina, her name means that she's the mother of the illumination. She departs, but she also becomes sanctified and becomes identified with the Virgin Mary. Now, that myth, as it turns out, can be traced back to classical antiquity, and Heracles had an encounter with this same strange mermaid serpent female in Scythia. And that female is just another version of the goddess, the Gorgon Medusa. And I think that we've danced around the subject for so long that we finally have come to realize that the best way to describe this Gorgon Medusa is that she's a fungal anthropomorph. And suddenly she is a mushroom, but the same assimilation of her occurs, so that in Athens, next to the 19th century or 20th century cathedral, basilica, there's a 10th century basilica built out of the stones of pagan temples, used as not only as building pieces, but obviously with some kind of reverence, because they're all displayed, but with no particular significance. But you see all these pieces of ancient temples built into the walls of the little basilica, and the church is dedicated to the Virgin under the epithet of the one who is the Gorgon. Now, that's amazing. But anyway, our take on Melusina Plancaro is that this fairy goddess from pagan times would, of course, have been the goddess of the people and of the ruling elite of those people. And when times change, the elite still remain in control. The reason they were powerful in pagan times is because they were favored by the goddess. And so when they pass into Christian times, they are still favored by the goddess. And so most of the ruling families of Europe claim blood descent from Melusina. And as I said, she merely is the old goddess who becomes re-identified now as Saint Melusina the Virgin.
So how does all of that sort of stuff tie into, you know, you hear of these stories like the Rothschilds, and they tie themselves all the way back to Egyptian or mm-hmm. pre-Christian Judaic times. Is that the same story of Melusina that traces back into those other areas, or is, you know, what's fiction and what is fact there?
Well, you want to know basic reality. You want to know the truth. It's like the werewolves. Do they exist or not? I mean, Plato claimed descent from Poseidon. Now, is that possible?
Well, I see the point that you're trying to make. I guess it falls into the realm of belief then, or what becomes what we recognize as anthropomorphism and what we recognize as literal history.
And if it is the source of the family's power, it's not going to throw it away. It's going to cherish it, but modify it. And that's what happens with Melusina.
Very interesting. So, well, all of this ties back to Melusina.
I find all of this very interesting, and there are the easier things to talk about, which are simply what drugs were available and what drugs were being used for what purpose, and one can leave it at that. But on the other hand, the more interesting part is, do these other realities actually exist, or are they only fantasies? And they probably really exist.
Well, you know, I would probably
Which shouldn't be hard for people to accept. I mean, because most people think that when they die, they're going to go and sit at some divine banquet with Jesus. I don't think that. But, I mean, that seems to me harder to accept as a reality than the fact that at present around us there are an infinity of ways of reorganizing our perception of this limited reality, and so that even if you just do the simple exercise of trying to see the space instead of the objects that define the space, to make you realize how confined you are by certain modes that you've been trained in for perceiving reality.
Well, I think that hits squarely exactly where Tom Roberts' research goes into looking at single versus multi-state consciousness. And then when we think of, like you brought up earlier, physics, and especially like string theory or M theory that discusses, I believe they're up to 11 parallel dimensions now. Should we? If these entheogens, and like Peter Webster argues, cause us to increase our salience, our ability to perceive things, and it brings us, as Tom Roberts argues, into a level of multi-state consciousness or awareness where we're actually able to see and perceive more things, then is it confined to a chemical reaction in our brain, like some argue, or is it a real multi-dimensional experience? And I would probably tend to agree with you that it's the latter rather than the former, you know. But either way, it's all chemical reactions. But do these chemicals have the ability to engage hyperdimensionality, as if that's a real word, or not? But maybe something might be there. So you've got Your new book on Mithras coming out. Can you tell the audience a little bit about where you're heading with that book?
Well, in order to excite some kind of uproar, we gave it the title The Drug Cult That Civilized Europe. We, of course, are aware of the fact that Europe was very well civilized before it was Romanized. And so it was colonized by the Roman Empire. And it was the drug cult of Mithraism that was espoused by the ruling elite, the bureaucrats, the emperors, and the army, that held them together and gave them the power to impose their view of organization upon Europe, which was already very well organized, thank you, in its own way. But the way that they cemented their brotherhood was through a series of drug-induced visions as an initiation. And we, in order to have some kind of ascendancy in the experience, obviously, it's not going to just be one drug. And we don't know exactly what drug was used at which stage, and ultimately people are always willing to substitute one drug for another whenever they need to. And so probably a variety of drugs were involved, including cannabis. But the mythology of the religion involves this phenomenon of fungal anthropomorphism. And so it's a mushroom that is the basis of the mythological foundation of the religion, and it's quite probable they ate mushrooms, but they couldn't find mushrooms. They eat something else. As I said at the beginning, when you say if I said that they had some other drug, people would be less offended than if you say and they probably ate mushrooms. But somehow people really hate the idea that people eat mushrooms.
Well, you know, and it's interesting because, like, mandrake is mentioned right in the book of Genesis, right at the beginning of the Bible.
Yeah.
And what is it, chapter 30, 14 through 16 or something like that?
Yeah.
And
but this business of alternate realities and parallel universes and so forth, it should be so obvious that something is involved. If we just contemplate the fact that I'm sitting here talking to you on a on a wireless phone and staring at my computer, which isn't on right now, but it's all set to pick up the whole web if I just turn it on. And all of that communication is right here in the room with me, and I can access it only with various instruments. And so you are one of those, we as people are one of those instruments that accesses reality too. And so we can find ways to access other things than what we have been trained to access with our limited organs of perception.
I wanted to talk about the word entheogen that you created. And the reason why I wanted to talk about this is I know it's old news for you since you created it 30 years ago, but recently it's come up that entheogen for some people is too religious for people to use in terms of one of the things that I find most interesting about that is you're one of the least religious people that I know who's proposed this term. And to me, I don't see you proposing it in a religious sense, but in a self-developmental sense.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, one of the people that were working on this team working on the rock fresco is another scientist like Brian. And he said that he felt that entheogen presupposes that the nature of the experience is religious, and he wants to limit it simply to the fact that it changes the organ of perception, and so he wants, and I said I'd go along with that for the purpose of this paper, that he wants to call it neurotropic, which merely means it affects the nervous system, which is, as a scientist, is, I guess, a more prejudicial term for the phenomenon. You're not judging what the phenomenon is, you're just saying that something induces it. So I can understand his point of view.
Right, but if I'm writing
about myth and religion, I don't think I have to pretend that I am adverse to considering the possibility that there is a spiritual realm that has meaning.
And it isn't really, though, the point of it that you're not discussing, you're manifesting some Christian god or Egyptian god or any other god. Really what you're discussing is entheogen, or the development of, or the generation of God within each of us. So it's like, how does that really fall into a category where people are prejudiced against using it because of so-called religious connotations? I just don't find them there.
Yeah. But in one of my classes this term, I began with a small group, and the first assignment was for them to go and find some source what they thought was the best definition, not from a library, but from some occurrence in literature or art, of ecstasy. And I didn't mean the party drug. And they really didn't know what they were looking for. And so I came up with various ones I typed out for them and brought them in. But they were very thrown off by the idea that I wanted to talk about what was the experience of ecstasy. And we finally got safely to the point where ecstasy basically means that you stand outside of yourself, which means that you have the experience of yourself as a different person, which is the basis for realizing that there's an infinity of yous possible. I'm not sure they're still happy with it, but anyway, especially since people are very, very reluctant to talk about drug experience. And I didn't want them to talk about drug experience. I wanted them to talk about what they thought ecstasy was, since we were going to be discussing Greek drama, and the god of drama is the god of ecstasy.
What is the most important concept or idea that you would like people to take away from this interview?
I guess that's sort of it, to be aware of the fact that you don't have to be limited by what society has defined your role to be. You have a possibility to experience things that you would ordinarily think were not possible. In rewriting the material about the Eleusinian mystery in the Sacred Mushroom to the Goddess, I wrote what I would not have been able to write when 30 years ago when I worked with Wasson and Hoffman. They had much more experience, of course, with mystic experience than I had at that time. But I came up with a scenario for what happened at the mystery, and that is simply that they journeyed into another reality and came back again. And since it was a guided experience, they didn't get lost, they didn't get addicted, their life was made more fruitful and happy by the experience, but that they actually did go someplace else and came back again, that they left their body, they became ecstatic, which doesn't mean to say orgiastic or that sort of thing, that's one possibility, but they actually stood outside themselves.
Carl, would you like to give out the titles of your books as well as any contact or website information that you may want to give for the audience?
Well, if you look me up, you get my full bibliography, since the university puts everyone's bibliography on the web. And so it's not hard to find what I've written. I've written quite a few things. Only some of them have to do with myth and religion. But The Road to Eleusis, Persephone's Quest, The Sacred Mushrooms of the Goddess, The World of Classical Myth, those are the ones that have, and The Hidden World, those are the ones that have to do with mythology and religion.
And then you've also written a couple of, or a few books on Latin and Greek. For those who want to learn Latin and Greek, his books are highly recommended.
I'm hoping you're going to start out on your Latin studies with my book.
I am hoping to, too. As soon as I have some money to purchase those books, Carl, I promise you that I will dig into those. Well, you know, we've been very tight the last few months, and all of the books I've been reading have been review copies that people are sending me, and I've actually gotten so many of them that I'm falling behind on other stuff.
You know, with Amazon, they sell used copies, and so often you or someone else mentions a book, and I look it up, and I say, well, I'm not going to pay that for it. And then I find that there's a used copy, and I can get it for 30 cents. So I buy it.
All right, well, I'll look for a copy of your book for 30 cents. I won't tell you if I paid that much for it or not, but hopefully your books hold more value than that. And this concludes Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 25. I've been interviewing Professor Carl Ruck from Boston University. And Carl, thank you so much for being a part of this show for actually your second time now. You were actually in podcast number one was our launch show that I recorded with you at your house.
Well, and, we get to see each other again.
Yeah, likewise. I hope to come out to the East Coast area soon and do that again. So, all right. Well, thank you again, and I'll talk
welcome
to you soon.
Okay, bye-bye. Bye.